Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 125, where Rowan, Greta, and Tom are discussing an article from Stephen Barley titled Technology as an Occasion for Structuring, Evidence from Observations of CT Scanners and the Social Order of Radiology Departments, published in Administrative Science Quarterly in 1986. If you missed part one, you can access it through our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation.
So the other thing that he does after going over suburban, urban, and the multi-phases that we've been discussing so far is this kind of frequency analysis of the scripts where he's coded them all, and this is on page 101, coded all of them across the two hospitals, across the multiple phases, and each script. So let's say, for example, unsought validation or direction giving or clandestine training across both hospitals, just giving a count. On the one hand, this might be kind of archaic at this point. This, it's not really mixed methods, but at the same time, you're bringing in this count. And at the same time, there's not much of a baseline, you know, is, for example, in suburban in phase one, there were 6 unsought validation instances. Now, is that high? Is that low? What percentage of all interactions was it? So it's kind of neither here nor there. But at the same time, I found it quite helpful, regardless of its provenance. Now, it might have come in just because reviewers wanted some numbers in there. And he later goes on to run some regression analyses as well. But this table, so what is figure 2 in the paper, I found useful just because it does one thing that Qual often doesn't do, which is balances out kind of all the cells in the picture. So let's say, for example, the script of direction giving, right? So this was very much the case in urban hospital where the radiologists were very directed, saying do this, do that, very direct, one-way flow of information. And you do see a lot of those. So 47, like 50, a lot of scripts across the phases in urban. But you also see it in suburban, and that's not something that comes out necessarily in this story, but it comes out in this table where there were 10 instances. In fact, in phase one, so I'm reading along the top row of this table, there were 10 instances of direction giving and only 6 instances of unsought validation. So it's not as if direction giving wasn't happening. It's just that what is interesting, and that's how, of course, what we are, how we build qualitative work, was the relative frequency that, okay, but there's also, you know, in the case of urban, let's say there were 47 instances of direction giving and 0 instances of unsought validation, whereas in suburban, there were still 10 instances of direction giving, but also 6 instances of unsought validation. And hence, the actual findings narrative focuses on the unsought validation. But this table gives you that broader picture of, look, some of the stuff is still happening. People are, you know, radiologists. Ultimately, if you look at the table, the most frequent script is simple direction giving and direction seeking. But of course, as Qual scholars, we're interested in the more novel patterns emerging around this baseline. So I found the table surprisingly helpful, even though I was skeptical about its role in this paper or this study as a whole.
Yeah, I just took it as trying to provide a number picture to justify the separation of phases, because the frequencies, especially when you're moving from zero to non-zero or non-zero to zero, does indicate clear shifts in behaviors and interaction patterns. So it was helpful to at least provide this as a way of illustrating, yes, there really was a distinction of phase that's not exclusively tied to, say, the change of how they rotated radiologists or, you know, a particular structural activity.
Well, totally agreed, but I would say it's in the reverse, where he actually talks about in his method section about how he doesn't want to distinguish phases based on script changes, because that's not the focus of the theory. Like, the exogenous change is the nature of the technology and the work. And so what this table does serve to show is that even given that his phases were based on that, based on the work changing, the scripts do actually change significantly or meaningfully between phases, and it's not just a artifact of the way he's coded the phases.
And I think he further illustrates that in figure 3, right? Where he looks at the proportion of operational decisions made by radiologists at the two hospitals. He also shows like the variation across those phases. So this is on page 103. So you see the first, I guess, is suburban. You see a much higher proportion of decisions made by radiologists in the beginning, and towards the end it's way more by technologists because the proportions by radiologists are lower. And what you see more clearly in the second figure is that basically the period, like up till like 105 days since the start, most decisions in the urban hospital were taken by radiologists, and where only in phase 4 we see like lower proportions. So that means like some technologists also took decisions.
Yeah, and I mean, I do find, I know just a moment earlier I said some of this might be archaic based on reviewers wanting more, but I definitely think there is benefit in just some descriptive quantification. I'm not sure about running regressions and things like that, but at least giving a picture of the numbers behind it. You see it sometimes in papers nowadays. One that comes to mind is Ryan Raffaelli's paper on the Swiss watch industry and technology reemergence, but where, let's say, if nothing else, you're just drawing out a chart of the market share of different, you know, Swiss watches versus quartz, etc. And I do think we shouldn't be afraid of having a more of the kind of quantitative, at least descriptive context and backing, even in studies like that are ethnographic in nature primarily.
Okay, so he concludes the paper on this note, you know, to try to provide that descriptive, you know, quantitative picture. But now that we've gone through the paper and we've reflected on what he was trying to accomplish and how he's using this model, this feedback loop between action and institution, what do we make of it? I mean, I know I mentioned Barley and Tolbert. They came later. They tried to generalize it. But here's kind of the thought, because the struggle that I had with it, just, you know, sort of on reflection, is when does an institutional norm end and a script begin? Did we do enough to really separate the two? And like I'm not so sure that, I don't want to bring in Barley and Tolbert yet. I'm not sure that the later works necessarily differentiated in my mind where a script begin, you know, what's the difference, say, between a script and the institutionalized norm from when it's inserted?
This pretty closely aligns with my comment. And like, perhaps we can, you know, do the Barley and Tolbert one in a future episode, because it's also an important piece in the development of institutional theory in organizations. But when we go back to that figure one, what struck me revisiting this figure after, you know, many years, is that the process of institutionalization is a diagonal where the scripts emerge, but the effect of action on structure is a vertical one that indicates it's in one moment in time that action impacts structure. And I feel, having read the findings, that's a false representation of what happened. Because you did see in the first case, even though the technologists were more experienced, in the beginning the radiologists still enacted their role. So it was kind of more gradual. So why isn't that vertical line a diagonal as well, that goes in parallel with processes of script creation and institutionalization? Why does one have to be in one moment in time and the other one over time?
So, I mean, I see your point there, Greta, and I think, and Barley talks about why he did this, and I'll tell you why he says he did it, but just to jump to the conclusion, I think the resolution, a more accurate representation would be for the vertical line, so let's say the influence of the realm of action back to institution, to still be diagonal, but within a phase. Because the point of the diagonal for Barley is that it is something that exists before a phase So it's like affects you from the previous generation. Your institution affects actions today, but actions change the institution again for the next gen. So the institution is the one that transfers generation to generation. And the action to institution thing is happening intra-generation, according to Barley. And so I quote in page 82 at the very bottom, he says, after explaining the kind of diagonal and vertical arrows, he says, social practices therefore constitute institutions synchronically, while institutions constrain action diachronically. So the idea being that one side is a synchronous within phase action and the other is a cross phase action. But of course, it's not instantaneous. Even if you're saying it's within phase, it can still be over time. So it could still be a slight diagonal in the arrow in that sense.
Yeah, but the challenge that I have with it, of course, is that, and this is a general challenge of trying to take what is a complex phenomenon and try to depict it simply so that it can be readily communicated. Of course, this looks like it's a single action, a single script enacted and a single feedback loop that is performed sequentially. The enactment of scripts is overlapping probably dozens, hundreds of times at any given snapshot in time. So it gets really murky. I think if you were to try to say, like, you could have for a particular organization, like he showed, with an interaction between a radiologist and a technologist, that might be something that happens sequentially over time because you're limited by the physical presence of a scanner. But in terms of other instances of institutional activity where you have, let's say, a university that experiences some sort of a exogenous shock, like we're going to introduce distance education. Now, what you have, you know, it's a new technology, same idea. So then you have a whole bunch of actions or scripts being enacted at once. And the trajectory, as depicted here, may very well differ among those different interactions. And some of those interactions are going to be contradictory. So the sense of forward motion is perhaps, in that case, might not be the right way of depicting it.
Yeah, I hear you. But at the same time, the forward motion here is mostly a temporal one, right? Where in your case, the arrows might be different within the figure over time.
So I think one way in which he might capture it, although he doesn't explain that in the text of the paper, is the background. From phase 1 to 2 to 3, there's a different shading. And in the note below figure 1, he says the progressively denser backgrounds signify structuring's cumulative effects. And so, again, this is just, of course, me putting meat into it, but he doesn't discuss this in the actual paper. But the idea being that time is a forward progress anyways, phases move anyways, but some of these scripts might persist. So, you know, once a certain interaction pattern comes in, it might persist in a cumulative way, even if the thrust of the role relation is changing in one or the other direction across the phases. It's not as if the scripts just, you know, come, drop off in a linear way, but a lot of these role relation scripts, things might be building up in an accumulative way in the organization. Now, we can also imagine a question of how much coherence is there in that cumulative process. Like, is it accumulating towards chaos where you have different dyads of radiologists, technologists enacting very different scripts across the phases? Or is there convergence in a broader sense? And the feeling I get is that in his setting, at least, he's found or sensed some element of convergence.
I definitely recognize that for the suburban case, but I would say for the urban case, you know, this cumulative effect took a while to kick off. So I feel like across settings, you might not have this neat linear progression cumulative. When you change personnel, when you introduce a new technology, they disrupt. And so I don't think that over time we keep having cumulative effects. It might then break down, just like with COVID, everything broke down and we had to revisit how we did things. And then that kind of got institutionalized. And now, you know, in my university, they stopped using Zoom and everybody is very upset that we cannot use Zoom anymore. Now we have to learn to use Microsoft Teams. And we're so used to, you know, using this technology in our teaching, in our research, in our interactions. And now we have to replace the technology. So I feel like it might, over time, when you would follow it for a longer period, in a setting with different technologies, you might see this again and again, rather than a linear cumulative effect.
Well, perhaps when we look at, you know, literature on reversal of strategic change, for example, let's say one of these hospitals decided that CT scanner was a miserable failure and they pulled them out, go back to the old way. The residual effects of having introduced the scanner and removing the scanner, I think, is part of that accumulation. Even though it may not have direct bearing on the outcome, it can have a bearing on the institutional norms and the confusion of deinstitutionalizing what became an embedded technology. I think it is accurate to depict that over time, the effects do accumulate. It's just a question of how much the effects actually manifest in the institutional norms. I suspect that there's a lot of these cumulative effects that wind up being cast aside, or just, you know, like there's a don't care level. I don't know if that makes sense. Do you understand what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense to me, but I might be looking at it through a very specific lens, which is something I felt while reading this paper as well, which is, what's the long-term equilibrium here? For all you know, by the time both hospitals are in a position where every radiologist has at least 3 years of experience with CT scanners, and every technologist has at least 3 years of experience with CT scanners, there might be a very specific, like a predictable occupation-based designation of roles and scripts that is common across. And all of these little accumulations, these kind of quirks of the trajectories have been, you know, laid by the wayside. And what you have is, again, a bit more professionalization. Let's say technologists start to be trained in the same way radiologists start to be trained to not use CT scanners or to use CT scanners. And so now the new ones coming from their certification programs have already kind of convergent patterns of interaction. And so the long-term equilibrium is almost independent of, to put an extreme statement, independent of these particular pathways that Barley observes. That being said, of course, Barley's claims aren't that grandiose either. So his claims still stand, because his claim is simply that technology serves as an occasion for this structuring process to happen. Now, whether long-term it converges because of external factors is a secondary thing to his basic claim. But I did find myself curious, and my hypothesis would be, if you went back 3 years, 5 years, 10 years later, there would be similar role relations between radiologists and technologists, at least when it comes to the technology of CT scanners.
Yeah, I agree. And that's a great way to put it. This is, after all, like a micro level look at what is potentially a broader institutional process of coming up with what is that equilibrium. And yeah, and you're absolutely right. A lot of this noise level of part of the learning process of dealing with introducing the technology would fall by the wayside, except that it might linger in the minds of those who participated in this process. So then once the Technicare 2060 gets replaced by the Technicare 3060, you have a process anew by which those who went through this, like, it may be the ones who are introducing this new technology expect the equilibrium to persist, or a new equilibrium to be achieved quickly. But those who have the memory of the cumulative effects of living through the morass of actually fielding this are going to introduce their experiences, and we're going to see this scripting process anew, potentially, even if the technology, the 3060, is not actually that much different than the 2060.
Yeah, I mean, and I think one of the takeaways as I discussed this paper, not even as I read it, but at the end of this episode, is that definitely deeply embedded into his findings is the idea that this whole structuring process in this setting of hospitals and technology, or at least radiologists, technologists, and technology, is the findings are very sensitive to, again, to use his phrase, the relative balance of practical experience. And so if this long-term equilibrium might just depend on that, if over the long run, the balance evens out of who has how much practical experience with the technology, then even the people who were part of early, let's say, Technicare 2060, might still behave according to the relative balance in the given moment, as opposed to the imprinting effects of their origin, because we don't see much imprinting effects even here, where phase one to phase two to phase three things do change as the relative balance changes.
Yeah, moving on from the model to the method, because this paper has also become a template for how to study technological change. That's why we also spent some time discussing his method of data collection and analysis. I have two reflections, and both pertain to the nature of technology today versus, you know, a CT scanner. And one of them is that a lot of technology became digital, and so the context in which to study them might not be in a hospital setting, which is almost like a lab where people behave in quite predictable ways. The technologies today are embedded in our lives, cross contexts, cross organizations. So the interactions around the technology are much harder to observe. So is the method of looking at scripts still a feasible method to study changes in organizational practices, processes, structures, when we cannot observe the full organizational context? That's one. I had a second one, I lost it. So maybe it will come up later.
No worries. But on your first one about the nature of the technology, I actually think not only can it be studied, but it can be studied in broader ways, because in Barley's case, he talks about how you need participant observation because retrospective accounts could be biased and because organizations typically don't record this kind of data, so archives won't have it. But now archives could have it. For example, if you're working on some new like AutoCAD, you know, computer-aided design software with an offshoring base in a different country and the headquarters in California, all of the interactions might be over that software and the Slack messages or whatever it is. And so you've got all the interactions archived and recorded. And you could imagine similarly drawing up scripts of what way are directions going, what way is feedback flowing in, who is spending how much work hands-on on the tool versus who is just observing and sending comments or doing markups. So there's actually more ways of studying it archivally as well, given the digital nature of some of these technologies, especially if the interactions are happening purely online. But you can certainly still distill scripts from those kinds of interactions.
Yeah, I fully agree with you. And in that sense, like when the technologies allow us to trace the interactions around it and we are able to extract that from the technology, so this also has design implications in terms of data and who owns it and who has access. You could do a lot of analysis like Barley did. So in that sense, I agree with you, but I also feel like there is a role for observation, but perhaps it cannot be as structured and as focused and as complete as this is, because a hospital setting is basically a lab, and now we have technologies that spread across organizations, across cultures, whatnot. So the scale of it is just too much to capture in a dissertation project for a PhD student. I remember the second thing I wanted to say, and that is that now with AI-enabled technologies, we see that the technology itself changes over time. So how would this complicate the insights that Steve generated here, where the technology, as you interacted with it at T0, is very different from T1 or T2 based upon how you interacted with it? And how would that occasion the structuring of organizational behavior in different ways?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the AI, because there is really a danger of not including observation because of a presumption that AI could potentially provide what hours and hours of analysis would have provided in the past. The question that I would start with is, to what extent do the emotions surrounding any of these interactions come into play? And if you don't do observation, do you think that the archival data would sufficiently provide the emotional cues to capture what the interactions themselves do not have? Because that, to me, getting to the bias, I look at some of these interactions that he captured through direct observation, and a lot of them are not necessarily friendly. And the first thing that's going to happen, if you rely on archival data, may not capture the nuance of how friendly or unfriendly a particular interaction is. And then if you lose that, does that skew the data? Because naturally, or without the observation, you know that anything that somebody is going to do is going, they're going to put up the front. They're going to try to interact in a way that they are always perceived in the best possible light, kind of bringing back our episode on Goffman. And the inability to capture that is going to be a loss of very important information. And it's made worse by AI because even though we may get to the point where AI can still get the cues or do a good job of filtering cues as they are presented in data to round out this information, it still assumes that the archival data has those intonations in the first place. I don't know. I haven't yet seen something that really supplants just hardcore observation.
And the other dimension that AI, just to add to this, brings in, of course, is it's in the previous cases, it was still people interacting over or alongside a technology, but it's still people interacting with people. And now there'll be lots of types of work where it's, you know, a radiologist reading an AI, AI's judgment of whether a particular mass on a scan is a tumor or not, for example. But that's just interaction between the AI and the radiologist. It's not necessarily always mediated. Certainly in the case of generative AI and the chatbots, it's not always mediated by another expert who tells you how to use the chatbot. It's just you using it in your workplace.
Now, what I'm also concerned with in the, you know, kind of following on the discussion, especially going back to your point before on technological determination, when new technologies are introduced and there is a desire a priori of what the state of equilibrium is and the, I don't want to say disregard, but this process that we're discussing here is sort of like the messy aspects of fielding. And I guess the question is, to what extent are we reaching a point where, because of the desire to succeed, when we have these exogenous shocks of introducing new technology to make things better, to make things more effective, more efficient, however you want to define that, of treating all of this murkiness as noise and ignoring it? Because the noise, I mean, this noise that we're discussing, the challenges of actually introducing the technology and making it work is something that is very, very important for us. But to what extent is it important for practitioners who are trying to introduce technologies, who would prefer that it follow a neat, orderly plan?
I'm very happy you posed this question, Tom, and it pertains to one of the studies I have done, which is also about technology adoption, but then digital labor platforms in organizations. And thinking about this school of research that really looks at, you know, how does technology and the social process occasion change in the way work gets done, the way organizations are structured and organizations operate. It kind of says like what the economists put in the error term is what org scientists theorize. And what we theorize is that you cannot explain the outcome of a change process, but we can tell you what you're likely to encounter when you're going through a technological change in your organization. In Steve's case, it was very clear the technology was a CT scanner to be used by technicians and radiologists. In my case of a digital labor platform, I see it lands in the organization in all kinds of different places, by marketing managers, IT managers, procurement, HR managers, and they all see the technology and what it affords them to do very differently. But what we see collectively is if they have a clear problem in their work, they try to use the technology to solve that problem. They see the technology in a certain way, and they try to use the technology in a way that enhances their control over work processes. So this is insight for people that are responsible for digital transformation initiatives, organizational change. We always see that people use the technology in certain ways to achieve something. Here in the suburban case, it was the technicians gaining autonomy over the work. They expanded their role. That's what we often see. Why didn't in the urban case. Why did learning fail? Because the radiologists tried to expand their role. And that wasn't sustainable in the long term. Something had to happen because they were radiologists, not technicians. So that's why in phase four, there was more mutual problem solving and then the learning happened. So I think we have a lot, as a subject matter expert, we have a lot to tell to professions in the field. And that is way more than, you know, more macro scholars can ever tell you in terms of what you're likely to encounter when you're going through such a change process.
That's brilliant and inspires me about our work, my work, more than I probably am inclined to be inspired. But I think it also, when you put it that way specifically, Greta, where you said there's a lot we can tell about what to expect during change, setting aside long-term equilibrium and macro kind of views, it reminded me how that might even be more important. Whereas, you know, in the world of AI, where the rate of change is so fast, let's say in the CT scanner case, you might have within 2-3 years reached an equilibrium. And so then this what happens in the first 9-10 months is kind of noise. In, you know, the AI equivalent would be if the CT scanner is constantly every year changing its capabilities. In a few years, it's becoming like a universal medical imaging device. And a few years later, they're like attaching robotic arms and it's performing minor surgeries. Then you might be in the space of noise much longer. And noise is, of course, hard to predict almost by definition, but it is. But then at least research like this can help you, if not predict, at least characterize the noise a bit more.
Yeah, and which is one thing that I was thinking as you were talking is that, you know, this is where transition theory really can be useful. Because if I was to generalize, not generalize the interaction between action and institution, as in Barley's paper, but generalize the experience of what was going on, just, you know, getting past the 2-phase at suburban and 4-phase at urban, it was a transition in which you had the old set ways that had to be broken apart. You have the new equilibrium, the promise of the greater future, and you have the big, you know, in just about every instance of transition theory, whether it's organizational, individual role, all speaks of this liminal phase in the middle, which is messy, unclear, and oftentimes organizational leaders do not necessarily prep the personnel to be able to enter and navigate this liminal phase so that, you know, you end up in instances where when you go into that liminal phase, you start looking backwards and saying, man, you know, what was the bad old ways no longer look so bad. I want to revert back to that or things of that nature. And I think that that from a practical perspective, I think that this is a good case to sort of reinforce. If you're going to introduce a technology, that liminal phase is just going to be a natural part of it. How do you prep the workers? How do you prep the members? How do you prep the people to navigate that? It's not necessarily about full steam ahead towards equilibrium. It is, okay, we've done enough technological change to know what kind of interactions are potentially going to happen where everybody is in that confused middle area where we're trying to learn the new ways, but it hasn't cooked in yet. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does make sense. And what the learning is that you should not leave it unmanaged because then it has unintended consequences. That's what this study shows.
You know, we're coming close to time, so I guess we can do our some final reflections. So for me, this was a great opportunity to take what was, for my early PhD experience, one of the most challenging parts of trying to get into the field of understanding things like institution theory, structuration theory that I had no prior experience in. And to now go back to the foundational study, again, pushing on this theme of we've got to make sure that we understand the classics. Now to know what the author was trying to do, and to see see his works as a continuum over time was very illuminating because, you know, in the end, a lot of the work that he did started from this particular study. And what did this study produce? It produced a wealth of information about how we understand technological change, the introduction of technology, and the ways that organizations interact with it, which will now allow me to understand more about, you know, the more contemporary scholarship, because We have a whole section on digitization in our resource center in the website. And a lot of it all stems from the trying to understand the phenomena of how technology gets introduced and the impacts on organizations. And this really reinforces the foundation of that whole active, ongoing contemporary conversation. So it was great to go back and look at this study and understand where it all came from.
A final reflection for me would be, I think, circling back to what I said in the beginning about how I appreciated this paper a lot more revisiting it than when I first read it for multiple circumstances. I guess I just know more of the backdrop in terms of the theory, the sociology, and the methodology behind it. But and what I find useful, and I think a testament to the power of this paper, is the fact that I can see myself citing it for many different levels of things. I could see myself cite it just methodologically, the idea of how to distill scripts from observation data and things like that. I could see myself citing it just for the theoretical stance it takes of structuration theory and technology as an occasion for structuring. I could even see myself citing it for the specific findings where, you know, you've got these interesting dynamics of different professionals trying to negotiate their expertise while maintaining certain power structures or difference, and even specific tactics like unsought validation or clandestine teaching are quite interesting to me. And so that ability to kind of to cite across the spectrum or across levels of abstraction, I think speaks to the powerhouse that this paper has become. And of course, a final reflection is I'd love it if my dissertation work got cited as much as Barley's dissertation work.
My final reflections pertain more to the implications for technology today. And building upon what Rowan said a few minutes ago about how AI-enabled technologies are constantly changing. When we think about like the implications for the social order of organizations, the social order of work, of even of markets or industries or fields, I think there is a huge need for research today to look at technology and how changes are actually materializing now. Not only how they do it, but when, how often, because when these technologies constantly update, that is the next step in our theorizing. What assumptions do we have in technology adoption theory that don't hold anymore with the technologies today? And I feel there's a huge research agenda there that we can undertake. And I hope also that funders recognize that challenge.
And I just want to piggyback real quick that not only adoption, but also rejection. I think at the time in which this subject was beginning, the tendency was adopting more and more technology. Now we're starting to see technologies being explicitly rejected or whatever. And is that really the same or is that different? I don't know.
A nice rhetorical flourish to end with, yeah.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.